The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gap Test, to Keegan Michael Key or Not to Key edition. It's Wednesday, August 9th, 2017. On today's show, the Public Theater's new production of Hamlet stars Oscar Isaac and Key Michael Key of our title. We were very, very lucky to go see it. We'll be discussing with Isaac Butler. And then Friends from College is a new Netflix streamer. It stars, here he is again, Keegan Michael Key, Fred Savage, Annie Parise, among several others. It's an ensemble comedy about a group of old Harvard classmates hitting 40. And finally, we're joined by Washington Post reporter Dave Weigel to discuss his new book on prog rock. We've been waiting to do this one for a while. I'm so psyched it's finally happening. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
All right, before we go any further, I've been waiting to share this with you. It's my stupid story of my night seeing Hamlet at the Public. I walked from 39th Street and 9th Avenue down to the Public Theater, about a 2-mile walk, realized I was going to be a little bit late if I didn't hurry. It was drippingly humid out. I had to all but sprint the last 3 or 4 blocks. I go into the theater and it's like Nixonian flop sweat. And so simultaneously I'm thinking, well, the stranger's going to be sitting next to me. You know, maybe if I just press my arms to my side really tightly, I can contain the stink. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I couldn't believe how much I had sweated. And I walk in and I go to my seat. And in order to sit in my seat, I'm not the kind of person, believe me, who befriends the stranger sitting next to me ever. never done it in my life and never will. But I did have to say to this person, you know, a version of excuse me in order to get to my seat. So instead of saying excuse me, I say hi. And he looks up and it's Sam Waterston. The fucking DA himself. And I sit down.
Chong chong.
And I sit down and it's one of those, I don't know if this is like rooted in like, you know, physiological fact, but, you know, sometimes after you've worked up a big sweat, and you sit down and your body starts to settle, it like opens all of your sweat glands. It says, let's leave nothing in the tank here. Like, we don't need to reserve anything more. And I swear to God, it was like I was underneath an exposed piece of pipe in my basement and it was like dripping. It wasn't just that there were rivulets or streams of sweat. There were actual plunking wet drops of sweat going from my hair, the base of my hairline, onto my neck. And I'm just absolutely, and I'm like, I'm sitting next to fucking Sam Water. Like, I've never looked, anyway.
No, I love that story because I feel like the Public is like the great off-Broadway theater institution in New York. And you always see some New York theater actor type there and or Law and Order actor type, same thing. But my experience like that was that I went to see Hamilton there. My husband was sneaking into the row ahead of me, and then he like stopped and ushered me ahead of him in front of all these other people. And I was like, what are you doing? This seems so awkward. And then I saw that he had done that because the person on the far side of our pair of seats was Victor Garber, who is a renowned and wonderful theater actor, but also more pertinent to my interest, played the dad on Alias, the spy show with Jennifer Garner. And he was the most effusive audience member I've ever had the privilege of sitting next to. Like, at every pause between every verse, he was like verklempt with emotion at the excellence of Hamilton and was like, ah, oh, oh, and was like, bravo,
that is
and
just so clapping funny.
The whole time. Like, he was exuding fandom.
That's exactly what Sam Waterston did. He did it in this perfectly sort of self-contained way. So it wasn't, he wasn't like, you know, kind of like, you know, generosity signaling, you know, actorly empathy signaling to anybody, but he made these little vocal noises like, oh, oh, like appreciative vocal noises that distracted like not one whit from what was going on stage and let you know that this himself, master of the craft, it was wonderful. He was the perfect seatmate. And he went home with a bucket full of vicarious ooze on his left pant leg.
So you and Sam Waterston did meet in a way. He bears your DNA on his body.
he does. If someone axed him on the way home, I would be the principal red herring suspect in the first half hour of the Law and Order about the actor on a
Law
and Order
like TV
show.
There was a weird, feverish guy. I like that open meet cute. Like, it's the theater. You know, you see the actors on the stage. Like, it's a classic New York scene. And then there's just like a suspicious guy, just a super fishy guy next to our protagonist.
All right. Well, now that we're warmed up. Hamlet is the most familiar work in the Western literary canon, yet it's the obligation of every young or youngish actor to try to make it new. The latest of the challenge is Oscar Isaac, who is plausibly inheriting the mantle of his generation's greatest actor from the dearly missed Philip Seymour Hoffman. He plays the tormented and self-tormenting Dane in the new production at the Public Theater, which is directed by Sam Gold. We're joined by Isaac Butler, Slate contributor. Isaac, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Isaac, I mean, the commanding reason to go see this has to be Oscar Isaac, who, as I said, you know, he's inheriting this mantle of the greatest actor of his generation. Isaac, am I right in thinking this is not a small deal to have Oscar Isaac play this part? And also talk a little bit about who Sam Gold is and maybe what his history with the Public is and what he brought to this production.
Sure, absolutely. So first of all, in terms of Oscar Isaac's career, you know, he... right out of Juilliard, he's in Shakespeare in the Park, right? And then, you know, eventually he starts having this, you know, really impressive movie career. He does Inside Llewyn Davis, one of the most amazing film performances I've seen in recent memory. And then he is, you know, one of the leads in the new Star Wars franchise. And then, you know, you could read this as kind of announcing his arrival to that upper, you know, echelon of the field by choosing to do Hamlet. One of the challenges with doing a play as familiar to its audience as Hamlet, and really I don't think any play is more familiar to its audience, is how do you make the audience hear it or experience it in a fresh way? Or if you're not going to do that, how do you instead comment on sort of Hamlet itself, right? Those are sort of the two approaches that you can do. And I think Gold is actually doing a little bit of both of those things. So Sam Gold, there was recently a New York Times Magazine profile of him, rose to prominence as the director of Annie Baker's early work. And then he went on from there to direct the musical Fun Home. And then this year, on top of doing Dolls House 2 on Broadway, he has directed three major classics productions. Othello with Daniel Craig and David Oyelowo at New York Theater Workshop, The Glass Menagerie with Sally Field on Broadway, and now this Hamlet, which has Oscar Isaac as Hamlet and Keegan-Michael Key as Horatio and a bunch of other really great actors in it.
I'm gonna hazard as someone who doesn't have exhaustive knowledge of this, but that Oscar Isaac was a tremendous Hamlet that people may be talking about for decades to come, and that this was notably original staging. Am I correct in those judgments?
I thought that Oscar Isaac was a very good Hamlet. I think he's a great actor. I completely agree with you that he is probably inheriting that title, the greatest of his, at least male actor of his generation, from Philip Seymour Hoffman. I thought he was a very good Hamlet. I actually think the really brilliant performance in this production was the journeyman stage actor Peter Friedman, who is playing Polonius and one of the gravediggers.
Yeah, Polonius really stole every scene he was in. We compared him afterwards, me and my partner saw the show together. We compared him to kind of an Alan Arkin type. He's sort of like a crabby Jewish Polonius, and he does that incredibly well. And he has this way of speaking the lines. Polonius speaks in prose, I think, more often than some of the other characters, so maybe this makes it easier, but he speaks the lines so offhandedly, and they just sort of don't sound like they could possibly be 400 years
old. Right, so wait, before we go further, let's spark note this a little bit for some of our listeners who haven't read it recently, but Polonius is the father of Ophelia and Laertes and an advisor to Hamlet's stepfather, the king. And Polonius is, if nothing else, he's probably most famous for giving this long, sententious speech filled with, platitudinous advice to Laertes that ends with,
right,
to thine own self be true. And what I loved about that, Isaac, was he's giving it, and he's playing him as a, I mean, Polonius is such a mixed figure. He can be played as a complete fool. He can be played as a fool who occasionally says something wise almost by accident. In that speech, what I loved about it is he's being sententious and long-winded in a very funny way, and then he places the palm of his hand on the cheek of Laertes, and he says with an immense amount of tenderness and sincerity, says, you know, this above all else, to thine own self be true. And I thought that was electric.
I think what Friedman does that's so great, and I should say that, you know, Peter Friedman's been delivering home run performances and plays, you know, since I was in Short Pants, and is a versatile, incredible character actor. And what he does really well with that Polonius is Polonius doesn't know that he thinks he's an incredibly wise man giving this tender advice. Contextually, he is, because he's constantly wrong about what Hamlet is doing and why. And so I thought, you know, for him to not go for the easy laughs in that scene was a really great choice. You never get the feeling that Friedman is laughing at the character, which, for example, when I did it in college and I was Polonius, you know, it's an easy way to get approval from the audience to kind of wink and be in on the joke of Polonius.
Mm-hmm. Before we go any further, most of the people listening to the segment will not have a chance to see the show. We felt compelled to talk about it because it's Hamlet and because it's Oscar Isaac. Talk a little bit about the production. What looked and felt different about this one?
Sure. So Sam Gold, this is actually Sam Gold, director Sam Gold's second major production of a Shakespeare play this year. His other one was Othello, and they share certain similar approaches. So one of the things is that it is less a conceptual set. You know, we're never in a throne room. A lot of productions of Shakespeare will either use, you know, very literal locations. We're in a throne room, we're in a courtyard, etc., or they kind of have some concept of where it's set, like, you know, we're doing Hamlet on Mars or, you know, something like that. What both of Gold's productions of Shakespeare this year have done instead is kind of create an environment that the play takes place in. So in Othello, it was this kind of wood-paneled barracks. And here it's a kind of red-carpeted, a friend of mine jokingly referred to it as a rec room, but, you know, it's this sort of red-carpeted three-quarter thrust space. The actors are on stage the entire time. There's very seldomly any attempt made to really let us know where we are. And then on top of that, there's lots of doubling. The actors are all playing multiple roles. Even Oscar Isaac plays one of the players in the play within the play at one point. And they're in very contemporary dress. You know, they're basically in jeans and t-shirts most of the time. And they have cut out of the play everything having to do with Fortinbras's invasion of Denmark from Norway.
Right, so the final words of the play are actually spoken by Horatio rather than Fortinbras. It's very strange not to have that somebody coming to the rescue, essentially, at the end of the play.
Yeah, it's a very hermetically sealed world, the Hamlet that Gold has created, right? There's not the sort of sense of exterior politics or exterior religion. It really is all about this room and these actors, as much as the characters kind of trapped together in this experience.
And it's a very small group of actors. I don't think we've stressed that, but I counted upon leaving, and I think basically there's nine people in the whole production. I mean, other than the main characters that you think of with Hamlet, Claudius, Gertrude, Polonius, Hamlet, Horatio, there's just sort of two extra folks who come in and do Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. They're very funny, and they do Bernardo and Marcellus, the two guys keeping watch at the beginning. But other than that, there's no one around. So there's a very, very intimate feeling to the production.
The other effect, I think, of the staging, and this seemed conscious to me, that I'd be curious to hear you comment on, Isaac, is that red carpeted rec room feel, kind of church basement vibe. What it actually does is extend the decor of the theater itself, which has sort of got these kind of red carpeted stadium seats. And so you sort of feel like you're at a rehearsal, or you feel like the place that it's happening is a theater, right? You feel like they're putting on a show. And that feels almost more like what the set is meant to evoke than anything else.
Yeah, and that is definitely a hallmark of Gold's classics productions, that they feel like they're essentially set in a rehearsal room. And in fact, his Glass Menagerie, which is on Broadway recently, had basically no set at all, and really felt like a rehearsal room. That's a very appropriate choice for Hamlet, because Hamlet is constantly, the character and the play, they're both constantly making references to the architecture of the Globe Theater itself, when that it is in the Globe. And many of the scenes are actually stageable pretty clearly if you just read the text as to where people are supposed to be. And it's a play that is, of course, obsessed with the idea of performance.
Isaac, let's focus in for a second on the performance of Keegan-Michael Key as Horatio. You know, he's a comic actor, you know, known to most people from Key and Peele. What did you make of his performance? And then let's move on and talk a little bit more about Oscar Isaac, what you liked and didn't like about his choices. But first, Key, what do you think of him in this role?
Well, it was nice to see a Horatio who actually had personality. I mean, the problem with the character of Horatio tends to be that Horatio is just kind of standing there watching everything. And then Hamlet gives this whole speech about what a great friend he is. But he kind of doesn't, you know, he's just kind of there. And it was nice to see Horatio where you sort of understood their friendship. Like, maybe they're the Wittenberg class clowns. You know what I mean? And that's what their bond is about, is that they can sort of mock authority and see through it. I will say that the personality he is given is sort of what you would expect Keegan-Michael Key to do. You know what I mean? It's very much in line with his performances in Key and Peele. But I also thought, you know, Hamlet is a long play and it's got a lot of humor in it that people often miss. And I didn't mind that I was laughing quite a bit while watching.
I could just add that this was unexpectedly hilarious, like rolling in the aisles funny production of Hamlet, which doesn't mean that it sacrificed any of the tragedy or seriousness of the big speeches or the beauty of the language. And that was just something that Sam Gold and all the cast, I thought, did incredibly well, was bring out the comedy while not turning this into sort of hearty har Hamlet. And one example of that having to do with Key is that he plays, I guess Gonzago is his name, the king in the play within a play, right? The king who is has poison put in his ear in the player's play. And he does, I mean, it's the oldest trick in the book, but he does an extended comic death that won't end. And it is so incredibly funny. The audience was just dying. Just when you finally think he's had his last spasm, you know, one little finger will reach out and it'll all start over again. And it was awesome.
Yeah, to me, I mean, we've talked about this. This is the second time we've talked with you, Isaac, about Hamlet on the show, because we talked about the great piece you wrote for Slate about Fat Hamlet. And Oscar Isaac does not play Fat Hamlet in this play. He plays Funny Naked Hamlet, by which I refer to his decision to go pantsless for vast chunks of the first and second
act. Basically how he shows he's mad, right? The way that he pretends to be mad, or that's signified in the play, is that Oscar Isaac takes off his pants, which becomes this sort of running joke.
You just get to watch a lot of Oscar Isaac's tush the whole time. But anyway, I think when we spoke about Hamlet before, I expressed that it's never been my favorite Shakespeare play because Hamlet is so mopey. And, you know, I've said this to you before, Steve.
I know, but it's just so you.
Well, I will just say that this performance, for me, created this through line for Hamlet's emotions that made it both sadder and funnier at the same time. Like, the grief really felt like grief to me and not like indecision. And his shifting modes of being felt like the kind of the craziness of grief, the shiftiness of grief. I don't know, it the way that he rendered the role was just remarkable to see.
I mean, I couldn't imagine a better, that's certainly the best live Hamlet I've ever seen. I mean, I haven't sort of globally responded to this yet. Maybe none of us have, but I have to say that I walked out of it utterly thrilled and with my mind racing and thinking, feeling the way that you feel when you walk out of a great piece of art. I think it's an incredible piece of theater, and if anybody has a chance to go see it, they should do so.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, Dana. I feel the same way. My kind of global response to it was to have been completely floored, exhilarated by the whole production, including Isaac, but not limited to him at all. All right. Well, Isaac Butler, I should say he's a writer and theater director, a frequent contributor to Slate, a friend of the program. And he's the co-author of the forthcoming The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America. He co-authored that with Slate's own Dan Coyce.
Thank you guys for having me.
All right. Well, before we go any further, I think we have some business to take care of. Dana, what do we have?
Steve, we have a few things. First of all, a quick reminder about our live show coming up in Toronto, in Ontario, Canada, in collaboration with the Toronto Public Library and the Toronto International Film Festival. It's going to be during the festival on September 13th at 7 p.m. at the Toronto Reference Library. And as we've talked about on earlier shows, the tickets for this are free. They'll become available at 9 a.m. on August 23rd. So put a note in your calendar for August 23rd, because these tickets are going to go fast. We're also doing a special cocktail party afterwards at a nearby location. And you can check Slate.com Live for more details and get tickets for the after party, which also guarantee admission to the show. We've already sold out over 60% of these after party tickets. So if you're interested in doing that, grab a ticket before it sells out at Slate.com/live. And our Slate podcast pick this week is Hit Parade, hosted by our beloved Chris Malanfi, who was recently here to do the Summer Strut with us. The newest episode of his show is about the history of the charity mega single, which we talked about, I believe, a little bit in our Strut segment. So if you want to hear more from Chris about how We Are the World and other charity mega singles came to be, and trust me, you do, check out Hit Parade on the Culture Gabfest feed. And in today's Slot Plus segment, we will be talking about Julia's love for the online game of Boggle, which has boggled Stevens and my minds enough that we want to interview her about it. To hear segments like that and to get ad-free podcasts, you can sign up for Slate Plus, free for 90 days if you download our new iOS app at slate.com/app and get all the benefits of Slate Plus for 3 months for free. It's by far the easiest way to get these bonus segments and ad-free podcasts. So if you're interested in trying Slate Plus, free for 90 days, go to slate.com/app. Lastly, for business, we wanted to thank everyone, again, who left reviews for us on iTunes. We really appreciate it, and we are done asking you guys this for a long while, but that really does help more people to discover the show. And as promised, we're going to read one of our favorite and most helpful reviews that you guys posted over the last couple weeks. This is from someone identifying him or herself as Fine Art Daily, and excuse the bragginess, humble brag, but I'm going to read their very sweet compliment. Dana, Julia, and Steven are three people I would take to the desert island. The conversation would be lively, the opinions many and varied, and their combined intellect would see us through to our rescue. Thank heavens for the folks who read books, consume popular culture, embrace technology, and can speak in full sentences. They have expanded my cultural horizons, and for this I am grateful. Keep it up, folks, and thanks for the Slot Plus, insert French accent, s'il vous plaît, segments. Delightful.
Friends from College stars an ensemble cast. I'll name all of them: Keegan-Michael Key, Fred Savage, Annie Parise, Nate Faxon, Jae Suh Park, and Kobe Smulders. They are six friends from Harvard who are now approaching middle age. They are, for the most part, first-world problems made flesh as they struggle to publish their novels or tolerate their hedge fund bosses. It sounds like a recipe for nothing but a hate watch, or maybe a self-hate watch, and from the evidence of my Twitter feed, a lot of people are self-hate watching this. That's the spirit in which I watched it. Anyway, is this satire, self-satire, meta-self-satire? How many times do you need to square a qubit before you can just like it for what it is? Oh, we have so much to discuss here, but first let's listen to a clip.
Young adult.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think that's for me.
I don't know.
I do know, because I write literary fiction for adults.
Yes, I know, and you've won a whole bunch of awards for it. You won the Penn Hemingway and the Pushcart Prize.
Yes, I did.
You won a ton of shit no one's ever heard of.
Well, not no one. No one.
I know this is hard to hear, but Ethan, the great American novel is now the massive international young adult series with film rights and merchandising. That's the future.
Why are you being so agent-y right now?
Look, your novels all have teenage protagonists anyway, right? So you just have to choose like a slightly more exciting, genre-y way in, okay?
Max, YA is destructive, do you understand? It's all about adults who are refusing to grow up, and instead they read books that are for kids. It prevents you from moving forward and living your life, and it is destroying our culture.
So that's a yes?
Yes. Fuck you. It's a yes.
Julia, I kind of feel like you made me watch this.
I did.
Yeah, she explicitly said, you must watch this show because I can't stop watching it, even though it fills me with... Tell us what it fills you with, Julia.
This show was like watching a train wreck, but I couldn't stop. It was so mesmerizingly, confusingly bad. I couldn't figure out, like, each scene has a different comedic tone. Each actor seems to be acting in a slightly different
version of the show. They're all loathsome. And yet, I kept watching it and, in fact, watched it so readily that after I successfully convinced you guys to watch it to help me figure out how I actually felt about it, I was like, okay, Friday night, I'm going to, you know, eat my dinner and watch a few episodes of this show. I realized I'd watched the whole thing. Like, I'd used up all the episodes. There were none left, but I was like ready to watch more. And there's been a lot of hate for this show among critics and on Twitter, and then also some stubborn defenses. And I will also say that when I tweeted about the show and how confused I was by it and how I felt like I just wanted to watch the version of the show that Kobe Smulders was in, I got like more interactions on that tweet than on a lot of tweets. Like, people are interacting with this thing out there in the world.
Yeah.
And so I basically called in my favor and need you ace critics to help me figure out what the hell is going on in this show.
I mean, I have to say, for my part, I felt no desire to keep hate watching. I've seen three episodes. I'm glad I saw three because I started to get a sense of how the character arcs would develop, etc. But I don't feel that addictive energy vis-a-vis this show. Do you, Steven?
Well, I watched the whole thing.
Well, that answers my question.
My name is Steven Metcalf, and I watched all seven or eight episodes of Friends from College. I mean, let me offer a defense of my own epic self-hate, epic act of self-hate. Which, first of all, they are all very, very, very good performers, very funny performers, and it's sort of like it's like one of those basketball teams where you just like roll a basketball out on the court and then you pay whatever amount of money to watch them just shoot layups. I mean,
but what if the basketball's deflated, Steve?
Oh.
That was my feeling. I couldn't give up hope that it would be good because the cast is so good, and that in fact was what kept it going. In particular for me, it mm-hmm. was Keegan-Michael Key and Fred Savage. I thought
yes,
they were both great.
Exactly.
The women also, the two sort of rival women, Kobe Smulders and Annie Parise, are both great. But what does it mean to be great when the script is flat? I mean, that's what I mean
disagree.
About the deflated basketball.
No, I don't disagree. Okay, so just a couple things about what I genuinely loved about it is, like, you know, Key clearly is like busting out as an actor. He's, you know, he's mesmerizing in this. He was terrific in Hamlet, as we said. Fred Savage, it's so awesome to see this midlife renaissance of his. You know, he could have been that guy on Wonder Years forever. He's so talented. He's good in every scene. He's very funny. It's like watching world class lemonade makers with a stinky bucket of lemons. I mean,
that makes me sad. Like, Key is so vastly overqualified for his part. I mean, when you see him, he's a great physical comedian, right? As we talked about in Hamlet, and as we've seen all over the place, and Key and Peele, etc. Amazing physical comedian. He gets very little chance to do slapstick in this show, and when he does, it's for some of the very few times that you laugh out loud. I just feel like Nicholas Stoller, the creator of the show, co-creator, doesn't understand what a treasure he has in his mm-hmm. on his hands, not just with Key, but with all these performances.
Look, so we're all on to the... Now I'm going to repeal all of my defense of it. I mean, so we're all, I think, onto the same vein here, which is that the writing just isn't good or consistent enough. The show is about one thing preeminently, right? The one excusable thing about the show is that it's sort of about the annoyance that it produces in the viewer. It's about these six people who cannot, at least when they're together, they recreate all of the energy and joy of discovering one another at Harvard 20 years before, to the absolute destruction of every other life relationship they have. Like, the energetic force that they generate internally as a group of six, the friend group, as they call it, you know, has this, you know,
that's
massive...
the most charming thing about the show, that they can't.
Yes,
come up
I agree.
With your name.
Right, it has this like massive negative externality, and the show's conscious of that and about that. The problem is, you know, Julia, is that they're approaching middle age, and all of their life problems feel faked, contrived, and they don't otherwise, other than in this rapport, they don't otherwise feel like real people with adult issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most perceptive review I read of the show, or at least the one that challenged my assumptions the most, was one by Alan Sepinwall at Uproxx now, who argued that everything off-putting about the show is completely intentional, that it is like a self-conscious anti-nostalgia screed, that it's about how people ruin their lives when they are, you know, man children and women children and can't grow up and accept the consequences of being an adult. And so you end up hanging out with these adults who keep making really stupid decisions and seem idiotic. And, you know, Nick Stoller has made a bunch of movies that are pretty funny in a kind of exaggerated comic tone.
Yeah, he made Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which is a movie I love and often return to. I mean, I think Nicholas Stoller is a great choice to make a show like this, and I'm not quite sure where this tone of insularity and claustrophobia comes from. Maybe that he co-wrote it with his wife, who was his college friend from Harvard, and that it's too close to their story and it's their in-jokes. I'm not quite sure, but it doesn't seem to be ever reaching for larger themes to me.
Well, and I think I disagree with you guys about which performances I found moving. Like, I think I found Key's performance in this not successful because it feels like he is in the antic. Stoller also directed both versions of both of the Neighbors movies, which I think we really loved the first one and liked the second one less, but have a similar exaggerated antic comedy to them. And I felt like Key was in that exaggerated antic version of the movie where, you know, there's like dead pets and broken windows and kind of scampering around. And I just like wanted to watch the earnest soap about 30-somethings. Basically, I feel like this is 30-something from my generation. And it's like trying to be too cool to actually just be a soap opera about 30-somethings. And I wish it just had the courage of its convictions and was a soap opera about 30-somethings. Like, I think mm-hmm. it's the soapiness that kept me watching and all of the, like, oh, aren't friends horrible? Aren't these, you know, like, the actual problems facing 30-somethings I know mostly are not that they can't stop acting like children. I will also say the other thing that you know, forced my self-honesty is that this thing is filled with the music of my youth. Like, if The Big Chill is the musically nostalgic 30-somethings reminiscing and fearing death together, you know, totem of our culture, like every song I loved that was on a mixtape was used as a like outro to credits in this. And it just made me cry.
Because you realize that you are Nat Faxon, Kobe Smulders, yeah. And
I'm a cliche.
The music is great, I have to say. What all is in there? There's Pavement, there's Corner Shop, there's Liz Phair. The music is super well chosen, and I like that there's
Breeders,
no comment. Yeah. Like, they're not listening to the music in the story, so the presence of the music is, in essence, a commentary on their stage of arrested development.
Mm-hmm. I will say, I feel that I should acknowledge that after sharing in various forums that I was hate-watching the show, our dear colleague Allison Benedict DM'd me and was like, it's just good. You just like it. Like, you watch the whole thing, you're talking about it. Like, maybe it's just good. And I think that's like a fair. I mean, I don't actually think it's good, but I like want there to be a second season. And I think I have to be honest with myself and our audience about that.
Is there any word on whether it will be picked up for another season?
I mean, Netflix is such a mysterious master. Who knows?
I think that there's a fundamental error at the heart of this TV show, which is that it thinks it's about how a codependency can evolve, a nostalgic codependency can evolve between this group of six friends, and it forms this kind of mirror in which they're always, you know, the collective mirror in which they're always great, they're always their younger selves, they're always fun to be around while everything crumbles around it. I think that's the wrong mirror. I think inadvertently the show is about how a certain style of Hollywood writing is just self-fucking-referential. I mean, it, you know, the mirror really is The Big Chill, you know, 30-something and Girls. And it seems more extracted from that than it does from anybody's real life. And real life is alluded to in touchstones like the Pushcart Prize or marital infidelity, whereas it doesn't seem to be drawing on anyone's actual experience of real life at all. And the closest that could come to being satirical is just sort of saying, well, that's kind of how people construct selves now, like performative selves in a way. And it's how we perform for one another. And so maybe at that level, it sort of worked as a satire. And maybe that's why I watched it till the end. I don't know. Just thought I'd throw that out there. Okay, so in sum, the show is awesome and we loved it. It's called Friends from College. It's streaming on Netflix. Check it out and come to facebook.com/culturefest. Oh, and one thing very quickly. Dana, are you with me on this? Billy Eichner is very good in this.
Yes, and he's one of the very few who doesn't. I mean, of all things, right? He's the most restrained performer on this entire show. So yay, Billy Eichner.
Dave Weigel is a national political correspondent for The Washington Post. He is a very, very good friend of Slate Magazine and an alumnus and a friend of this program. He has written The Show That Never Ends, The Rise and Fall of Prog Rock, a book about progressive rock and roll, prog rock. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's really good to be on again.
So, Dave, this book had its origin in a big project that you did for Slate when you were a political correspondent for us here, where you spent a month researching and learning about the history of prog rock and essentially mounted a defense of prog rock, a much maligned type of music. Can you talk a little bit about, like, can you play for us a song or conjure the song that sparked your interest in this form of music?
I'd probably start with Roundabout by Yes, which is extremely obvious. I can't pretend that I came in through the most the coolest and most obscure back door
of
progressive
rock.
I don't
know if you need an arcane doorway to an arcane form of music. You think you're allowed to go through the front door.
I was 14 or 15 and into heavy metal and found a rock critic, Mark Prindle, online back when everyone was just updating their websites with HTML, who loved metal but also loved this. And I found a tape of Yes's Fragile for, I think, $3.77 at like a cutout bin. And so Roundabout was what kicks out the album. And that was a lot of what makes the music fun and worthwhile is in that song, even though it's a hit that doesn't get as into as many weird places as some of the other music.
You say something quite interesting that I wonder maybe if it could provide a starting point for us, which is that up until about 1968, British and American rock music were going kind of in the same direction. They were you could argue that rock and roll was Anglo-American phenomenon, and in 68 they split and they go in different directions. Why is that maybe one way to get into what made prog rock distinctive?
Well, it's because of something that a lot of critics have pointed out in the reviews of the book, and I don't mind them pointing it out, which is that Britain did not have a tradition of black American music for reasons I probably don't need to go into. They're pretty obvious. And you had a lot of musicians exploring the influences that they grew up with. Insofar as they went to church, they heard Anglican choral music. They heard a lot of classical music. The influences they got growing up in like post-World War II Britain were different than the influence of Americans were drawing from. So there's this break where when bands get extremely ambitious, there's this the same sort of kind of acid test scene you see in San Francisco for the Grateful Dead, similar things happening in London and Europe, but the direction they're taking it in is much more grandiose and much more structured. I mean, these don't become jam bands. They become sit for 20 minutes and explore this very put together sonic journey that these bands have put together. Now, they get there eventually. There are some classic burnout jam sessions at these like all-night raves, but they go in a much less folky direction than American psychedelic music and a much more layered and I could say pretentious because I've said so much I don't really find it pejorative anymore. A kind of big-headed, expansive kind of music.
Okay, so for those of our listeners who maybe aren't overly familiar with this kind of music, name some of the big acts of British prog rock.
Well, you could go with Yes and Genesis, although Yes and Genesis are bands that both got very poppy in the 80s. If you kind of start in the 70s, that's the sound. King Crimson, who, again, morph very much between album to album, one of the main bands, Jethro Tull, and Emerson, Lake and Palmer, who are referenced in the title of the book, are kind of the icons of the music as it has come down to us through critics, which is as music that was abolished by punk in 1977. I mean, ELP, a supergroup of three very talented people who, for one of their first albums, record an entire classical piece. For one of their later albums, tour with a classical music orchestra until they run out of money. They're kind of the mascots of progressive rock. And as I've toured the book and talked about it, I found all these people who were secretly fans of them but didn't know how to express this. Because it's a cul-de-sac. It's a form of music that went in this direction and then kind of petered out. And they're a revivalist, but it wasn't as influential openly as a lot of other, even electronic music that was kind of coming up at the same time.
In one of the reviews of your book, somebody pointed out, and I like this comparison, that prog rock songs are sort of this, or more like a movie, right? They're kind of a narrative journey that you go on, as opposed to turning on the radio and hearing a 3-minute hooky pop song.
Yeah, and if you see them live, they don't deviate a ton from this. Maybe the guitar solos are going to be a little bit different, but they sound like Roundabouts, about 8 minutes long, and you hear it live, it's going to be 8 minutes long. It begins with this slow build-up, slow and quiet build-up. Starts with what you heard there and then slows down again. There are scenes with, again, the one thing you hear is this fluttering keyboard and this Steve Howell classical harmonic guitar. And yeah, they take you to different places in the song in a way that a lot of contemporary stuff, when people think of 70s rock, you know, it's big bludgeoning fog hat stuff. That starts and ends in kind of the same place. And these songs didn't. So that's why I got really interested in them.
Dave, can you further place the music in a little bit context around some of the other forms that were popular at the time or thereabouts, just so people have a sense of the arc here? So this was kind of at its peak before the rise of disco and punk and the rest, right?
This kicks off, you guys said it really well, it kicks off in the late 60s. It is I'd say our rock starts diverging into more psychedelia. So does theirs, but it is a much more structured kind of weirdness that they go into. And it's really 1969 through 74. These are gigantic bands selling out festivals, selling out multiple nights at arenas. Yes, and ELP especially are some of the biggest bands on earth. And they still have a following today, but they are, you know, blow for blow with the Rolling Stones and being open, even a band like Gentle Giant, which is one of the more kind of Renaissance music forward bands in progressive rock, they're opening for Black Sabbath. They're like not on the same level as them, but the music industry, which is like this big important player in this, music industry sees a lot of money in this sort of music. It is not niche music. Yeah, it's not as mainstream in a lot of construction as what's playing at the same time on rock radio, but it's super popular as album rock that you open it up and there is a intricate art and intricate lyrical content. And in the case of something like ELP's Tarkus, a whole mythology around a mythical creature they just made up, that kind of stuff was just super popular. And as I reported out, and I talked to a lot of fans too, because I'm 35 and I wasn't there for a lot of this, I think one thing that helped is just, there were fewer distractions in the late 60s, 1970s. There was a lot to do, but there wasn't the, I could download all this, or I could play anything I want, or I could watch any one of 50 sports live contests online. There was just immersing yourself in a musical culture made a lot more sense then. It's a little bit more of a break from society now. It was pretty mainstream in the period I'm writing about. So this was rewarded by that. And so when it blew up in the late 70s, it did. I mean, I've had some smart critics argue with me falling for this narrative. I think I do it because in all the research I did, it's just true that in the late 70s, music critics and music companies just, they're not selling as much and they abandon it and move on to punk and other forms of music. The crowds don't even shrink that much. It's just that the industry actually is selling more disco more interested in selling disco than it is in a lot of this stuff. And how long should a genre last? 10 years seems pretty good. I don't argue in the book that it was unfairly ended before its time, just that it didn't get its due in music history.
So, Dave, one thing I wanted to ask you about, because your book kicks off with this, is the sort of social shame associated with still being a prog fan in this day and age. And the very first sentence of the introduction of your book begins, "We are the most uncool people in Miami, and we can hardly control our bliss." And you're describing this cruise that you're about to go on with a bunch of diehard prog rock fans. So I wanted you to talk about that and how that came out in your reporting and just, you know, in general, in the reception of the book, and to what degree that drove your desire to make the book.
Yeah, I went on one of the three available progressive rock cruises at that time. There was Transatlantic, there was the Moody Blues Cruise, and there was this one. And I remember being pitching this as something I could write about and being very worried it was a cliche to go on a cruise and make fun of musicians. And it is a cliche. It totally is. People have done this with like the Weezer Cruise and the whatever the whatever kind of sub-fire festival on a boat people managed to put together. And this one, I just said, no, I'm going to take it seriously because everyone on this boat is passionate about this music that has been written off, and they know that it has. And that, I think, makes the community tighter. It almost reminds me when I'm old enough to remember when, you know, comic books like X-Men and stuff, pre-movie, or Tolkien, pre-movie, you wouldn't get beat up necessarily for talking about them, but the people who were interested in them were fairly cliquish, and that's fun. I mean, you overanalyze, you go down rabbit holes, and that's what I found with all the people on this cruise, a couple thousand people who, in general, were really good musicians. I think that kept the core of this music's fandom really active and intense. I mean, it was not hard when I was researching the book. It was not hard to find people who had personal libraries of old magazines about it because they never got rid of them. And it was not hard to find fans who could talk about it and point you in a million directions. Like the hard part, because the book was about a year late, the hard part was condensing that into one story.
So, Dave, my overwhelming association with prog rock is with one band and really one album in particular. The band is King Crimson, and In the Court of Crimson King, which just seems to me the one inarguably and superbly great prog rock album. Aren't they? They're a key part of the origin story of prog rock, aren't they?
They are. They come out of this not super successful band, Giles and Fripp, that are psychedelic, don't really know where they're going. They add Greg Lake, who is most famous later on for being part of Emerson, Lake & Palmer. They add this lyricist, Peter Sinfield, who writes these searching, strange poetic lyrics, and not just hard to diagram lyrics, but lyrics that are so recognizable as something alien and progressive that, yeah. And so this album begins with a 21st Century Schizoid Band, which is some noise that's really obscure and hard to figure out, and then this gigantic rock riff, and then a jazz piece that comes out of nowhere, and all of it works. All of it is compelling and fresh and amazing live, even kind of holds up on an album and sounds really not like nothing quite that had been written in Britain or anywhere else at the time. That Netflix show F is for Family has created a whole band with its own mythology aping this, because once you hear these lyrics about chains of prison moons and stuff, you don't know what he's talking about, but you know you're being transported into something else. And he's kind of lyricist and light show coordinator for this band that is kind of recognizably heavy metal in some ways, but then playing Bolero live and playing Holst's Mars theme. Just finding these extremely concussive things that they can really work out for minutes and minutes at a time, and also kind of floating them all over a mellotron, which is not the most hardcore of instruments. So you have this conflagration of extremely heavy guitar and then an extremely heavy bass and drums, but then a flute in a lot of the songs, really weird mystical lyrics and a mellotron. And that it really takes people by storm. It defines to a big extent what progressive rock sounds like. And I kind of quote some of the advertising and the reviews in the book. Like even reviews at the time were very positive about this music. And only was 10 years later where people retconned and said they always hated it. But this was, people like Peter Townsend were lifting this band up as this obvious, well, we were doing interesting things, but my God, look at what they're doing.
It's pleasurable how alt it is, basically. I mean, to borrow a term from the 90s. But one thing I was curious about is sort of how you square the huge popularity of these bands in the United States during their heyday and the like deep, aggressive, kind of nerdy counter-popness of them. Like, it's not I Love You, You Love Me, etc. Mm-hmm. It's not the romance of the bad boy in the leather jacket who, with his just naturalistic swagger and plucking on a few guitar strings with, whatever he learned on the back of a train is going to, make you move and melt. How do the nerdiness and the massive audiences square?
Well, it's nerdy, but it also is at its core often, four to six dudes with long hair and groupies playing rock music. I mean, I think it diverges a little bit from glam rock at the same time is a lot more transgressive when it comes to gender and sexuality. And it's on one hand more hard rocking, but a little more challenging of your worldview. As progressive rock, it really does feed on what you liked already and then add to it this kind of musical chops and intensity. And it just, I've always found people who really bang their head along with musical chops tend to be dudes who are not necessarily all nerds, right? It is a pastime and a something to hold your lighter up or high five people listening to that. It was then carried on by hair metal bands, right? Which were much more obviously, I was about to say dick swinging, but probably can't say that.
You can definitely say that if you
I can say dick swinging.
All right. Well, Dave, do you want to pick a track for us to go out on?
I'd end it with King Crimson's Discipline. So if I can use two, but this is an example of just how the music transformed too. It is. I really tried to rescue it from this imagery of elves and whatnot. When King Crimson return in the 1980s, they break up, they come back. Song like Discipline with all these interlocking guitars, I think, just demonstrates how much these guys should get credit for doing new things in music. And that's a good example. It's a fully instrumental song with guitars running at different speeds, percussion that is wonderfully hard to follow, and a bass that's doing something else entirely, and it all works. And so like that's the kind of music I came to love and may want to write the book.
All right, well, the book is The Show That Never Ends, The Rise and Fall of Prog Rock. It's by David Weigel. Dave, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And I should say that Dave has made a Spotify playlist of his favorite prog rock cuts, and we'll have a link to it on our show page. All right, well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Steve, I have a very simple Zen endorsement this week. As you scroll through your news feed and get exhausted and depressed and demoralized by the day's news, I feel like everybody needs breaks, sometimes visual, audio kinds of breaks, and some sort of window open that is restful. And to that end this week, I'm endorsing explore.org. Do either of you know this site, explore.org, with the live cams?
No.
So I'm looking at it right now, and it's this wonderfully simple, I hope they never make the interface more fancy than it is now, is a big page of thumbnails of live cams of animals all over the world. And so you can watch owl nests in, I don't even know where the owl nest is, but I was watching it for a while. You can have Steve's life and watch sheep in upstate New York, or you can go to Africa and watch wild safari type animals roaming the plains. And often you'll just the plains themselves and hear the sounds of birds, but you see whatever is happening in front of that stationary camera in that part of the world. Are you looking at it right now, Julia?
There is a bear straight up like catching spawning salmon in a waterfall.
Yeah, I'm watching
right
the
now.
Same thing. Yep.
So they're like leaping.
We're watching the same bear. So yeah, they will generally feature one when you go there. There's a big window where they'll rotate different animal cams. And then you can also scroll down below and pick the animal cam of your choice. You can have the audio up or down. And what I like to do is just find one of these in the morning that has sort of a nice, peaceful bird song background and leave it open all day. And half the time you're not even looking at the animal, you're doing your work, but you can always peek over at your bear or your owl or your zebra and see how they're doing. So explore.org, it's simple, it's beautiful, it's a break from the horror.
Fantastic. Julia, what do you have?
I have a sad endorsement today. I would like to endorse the work of illustrator Jill McElmurry. She did beautiful illustrations for the Little Blue Truck series, which also has further titles as such series do. Little Blue Truck Leads the Way, Little Blue Truck's Christmas, Little Blue Truck's Halloween. Jill, in addition to being a wonderful illustrator, was also a listener to this podcast and a sometime member of our Facebook community, and someone who I came to know a little bit as an online personage through that community. And she passed away last week. And she's one of those people in sort of a modern way that you can feel that you know a little bit. And so I just want to express my admiration for her work and send my love to her family and community, who I don't actually know at all, and just say that we will miss her here too.
Here, here. Jill McMurray was a wonderful artist, and she left the world way too soon. I was incredibly sad to learn of her death last week, and I do know her slightly. She's been a listener to this podcast forever and a reader of Slate forever. She wrote and illustrated several of her own children's books as well, and one that is a big favorite in our household is called I'm Not a Baby. The illustrations are just so virtuosically beautiful, and the text is very funny, so that's another recommend from me.
This week I'm going to endorse the piano playing of McCoy Tyner, who's probably best known for playing with John Coltrane. And it's forgotten, I think, a little too easily that he had this long, tremendous solo career. And I was reminded of it when on a Pandora station, the most beautiful piano jazz ballad I think I've ever heard came on. I was like, who is that? Just the playing, the touch, the tenderness of it was so amazing. And it turned out it was McCoy Tyner. He's playing a tune called When Sunny Gets Blue off of the record Today and Tomorrow from 1964. McCoy Tyner is wonderful. The Real McCoy is an amazing album. It turns out Today and Tomorrow is a great record. But if you need a way in, that's your way. When Sunny Gets Blue, check it out. You will not be disappointed. All right, Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest, and you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch, our intern is Daniel Schrader, and Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Networks. The Culture Gap Fest is part of that network. You can check out the entire roster of shows at panoply.fm. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you soon.